saying that
it's recording well. Great. So hello and welcome everybody to the ABCs of Green Politics. Hello everybody and welcome to the ABCs of Green Politics podcast with myself, Sinead Mercier, and my co-host, Saoirse McHugh. And today we're delighted to be here with Maria Ní Láthairte from the NUIG Disability and Law and Policy Centre in NUIG Galway, and also Deirdre Ní Chealachán from the Irish Council of Civil Liberties, a policy officer there. And today we're going to be discussing the topic of D, climate change and disability, and human rights as well. So delighted to be here. And so opening up the discussion, I'd just like to quickly maybe start off with Maria. I was listening to another brilliant podcast just a second ago called The Law is a White Dog in NUIG as part of the Tulca Arts Festival. And I was on it last year. I was at the festival talking about Marxism and environmentalism. So I thought it was really interesting what you were discussing there, and how accessibility how difference is kind of seen in different ways, and so I just love to hear your perspective on that, Maria.
I was so excited to do it. Like, doing an arts podcast is so much cooler than most of the things I normally do, so I got to feel very sophisticated there for a minute. But like, it's a really, really interesting series, and the piece that we were looking at is Mel, or A.M. Baggs, who was a autistic person living in the States, who was a really incredible advocate for nonverbal people and people who communicated differently, and how we perceive that, because there's a huge problem in the law where, you know, we decide that people are completely denied of legal personhood. And right now in Ireland, that happens under the wardship system, where you lose all right to, you lose legal agency and you lose the right to make your own decisions. So it was really, really just fascinating to get to kind of see that from an art space and talk about it from like a legal perspective, but also a personal perspective, because it's something that's kind of had a huge impact on me. And it's also just such an incredible piece of arts advocacy. That like it kind of sits between those two spaces. And I think when we talk about making change and different strategies for change, like, Baggs persuaded more people than I ever will as to the legal personhood and legal agency of people with disabilities. So it was a lot of fun to talk about that and look about that, because, you know, the ways we achieve change are very multifaceted, and seeing art do it is very exciting.
Mm. Yeah, brilliant. It's something I did a research project there for the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, looking at kind of climate change in Ireland and who might be worst affected, who might be most vulnerable. And one study that was done by the Department of Health in Ireland was that people with disabilities will be one of the most vulnerable groups, along with women and children, the elderly, and kind of targeted groups, Marie, which, using your own language, I saw you tweet that, really interesting that people aren't vulnerable, that they're actually targeted by the types of policies that we have. And the Paris Agreement itself kind of says that these are vulnerable groups, but, you know, why are they vulnerable? What is it in our society that has put them in that position? That'd be interesting.
Yeah. I completely, fully will the hill I will die on is that vulnerability is entirely socially constructed. That actually, if we empower people to be able to make their own decisions, to be able to kind of choose their lives, to be able to engage and navigate the world, that vulnerability is entirely mitigated. Like, women aren't vulnerable as like a biological reality. Women are vulnerable because we've like created systems where you are like less likely to be financially independent, you are more likely to have caring responsibilities, you are less likely to own property, all of these things. Like, it's the system that creates that vulnerability, and that's an equivalent with disabled people and older people as well. Like, a lot of the time disabled people aren't vulnerable just as like an inherent condition, but because, you know, they may have never experienced mainstream education or have been able to like have been taught the same things that non-disabled people have been taught, had the same opportunities for employment, the information that they need to navigate the world mightn't come in an accessible way, which just magnifies what like and creates effectively that vulnerability. And it's incredibly frustrating because, you know, when we talk about, like, we are talking about vulnerable groups, but I feel a lot of the time when we talk about that, we're failing to recognize that vulnerability is that cause of systems. It's not that I'm inherently vulnerable as a person, but just systems disempower people to make them so. And like, you can see it all of the time. Like, if we're to talk about like built environment and like the access there, like roads are so dangerous for people with physical disabilities or all kinds of disabilities in a lot of ways, and that's getting better. We've got more tactile pavements, we've got more curb drops, but like ultimately, like cars are still dangerous, and when like everything's built around cars and built around like able-bodied people, that creates a vulnerability as well. Like, that creates that imbalance of power. And I think it's reflected in like more than disability. I think disability is just often where that's more acute, because the level of deprivations that people experience of their rights are often that bit more severe.
Yeah, fascinating. And I had a great chat with Deirdre, and kind of just sussing out if she would come on our podcast, because we'd be delighted to have you, Deirdre. But just to, you had a very interesting insight there about, you know, what is environment? What is the conception of the world around us? Like, human beings are such incredible creatures that we can form and create whole societies and whole new utopias or dystopias. And maybe disability and lack of accessibility is one way where that's kind of, as you say there, Maria, so acute. Do you want to talk about that a bit, Deirdre?
Sure, absolutely. And just firstly, as someone who is legally blind on a very micro level, and to pick up on points made by Maria there, that navigating especially city life can be hazardous for someone with a disability, you know. And just a positive dimension of this, if we're looking at the nexus of disability and green policy, would be the opportunity we're presented with here to kind of redesign our landscape, you know. From someone who's visually impaired, I mean, pedestrianised areas, investment in public transport to someone who can't drive are extremely positive, you know. And then also, just to pick up on what I felt very interesting, what Maria was saying about disability as a social construct, you know. So just this idea that environment is in the conceptual sense is the disabling factor for most people. And as finally the green agenda has become mainstream and is gaining that traction, we're looking at designing policy that will shape our landscape, and so we are presented with an opportunity to kind of rebuild and to redesign a more inclusive and ultimately more sustainable society. Because I think to design inclusively is ultimately empowering people to live sustainably. We see that from someone as a person with a disability, from if you look at the labour market, it's not sustainable demographically. We have an ageing population. 1 in 7 people are registered as according to the last census, are certified as disabled in Ireland. It's not sustainable that they can be excluded from that. So I think if we are presented with this rethink, redesign opportunity, we could ultimately build a landscape and a future that's more inclusive and sustainable. I don't know if any of you are probably definitely familiar with, but if you've had the chance to read Sinead Burke's new book, it's called Break the Mold. I just think really very articulately and compellingly captured this idea of and the reality of trying to navigate a world that ultimately isn't built for you, you know.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I love Sinead. I'm a big fan of her. Just because she's the same name as me. But anyway.
Oh, yeah.
See, I have a long... Yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say that's fascinating what you're saying, Deirdre, that 1 in 7 people
Irish good at maths.
What percentage is that?
It's 13.5%, but that's the Irish figure. And there's something about how the way the Irish figure is calculated that we use a very narrow definition of disability. A lot of the international human rights organizations that work, or a lot of the international organizations, will use 1 in 5, which is 20%, which is higher. And it's also, it's a group that everyone's likely to join. Martin Nocton, the late great disability rights activist in Ireland, I can remember him turning around being like, this isn't just for me. He's like, this is for you if you're lucky enough to live long enough to join this group. Because it's one where our numbers increase as we age, because not all of us are born this way. A lot of people acquire disabilities over the life course. So it's kind of like the lotto. It could be you.
Absolutely. And I completely agree. I mean, say in my family, I'm the only person with a certifiable disability, you know, with a capital D. Well, I'm not the only person in my family who wears glasses or who has suffered back pain. You know, everybody will be disabled at one point in their lives, whether that's by virtue of a broken arm or mental health struggle. So that's completely true what Marie was saying there.
Yeah. It's really I suppose, because I probably myself have for a long time just kind of looked around at the world with quite a narrow view of disability. Like my little sister has a huge amount of different disabilities, from learning disabilities to physical disabilities. She's, God love her, she's been in and out of hospital her whole life. And I often, you know, you kind of do leave out things like back pain or, you know, needing to be in a wheelchair or a poor vision, because you're like, oh yeah, but those people aren't, you know, extremely disabled. But that's a really good point, that it's gonna happen, you know, or if you're lucky enough to live long enough, a lot of people will, you know, be included in those statistics, be it, you know, 13.5% or higher than that. But I thought it was really interesting what you were just saying there, Deirdre, that it's the response to climate breakdown is an opportunity, because we often say, you know, it's often said that it's an opportunity to kind of rearrange inequality and rearrange social structures and stuff like that. But it's also a public health opportunity. And I was wondering, is that particularly, do you see that particularly kind of being relevant to urban areas or more generally?
I suppose there's a particular obvious application and benefit in the urban areas if we're talking about better public service links. But why do we have to talk about public transport in the context of urban area? You know, I mean, I've written off for myself living outside of a city for that reason. You know, I mean, I couldn't operate in rural Ireland because I can't drive. Well, maybe, I mean, self-driving vehicles, they say 2040, but still a bit down the road. But yeah, I do think it's an opportunity. And I also, just another parallel, it might be a bit of a conceptual leap, but I've heard disability described as the new green recently as well, in that back in the day, it wasn't kind of seen as commercially advantageous or be beneficial from a PR perspective to be environmentally sustainable. It was seen as onerous, it was seen as costly. Well, now, I mean, you sell a product if you just stick eco onto it, you know. It's seen as responding to what society wants, and society for the most part ultimately values the overdue green movement, you know. And I think, and again, maybe I'm being excessively positive here, but I think we're coming to a tipping point of disability as well, for partly because of the demographic dimension I mentioned, and also because disability slowly but surely is being viewed as falling under that equality banner, you know. I mean, the disability movement is, you know, we had the civil rights movement in the 60s and we had gender equality. Disability rights is newer than that still, we're talking late 70s, 80s, you know. So it's finally, I think, employers and will ultimately recognize, the way they went through that process with them with environmental sustainability, that disability is something that will have PR benefits, but is ultimately in their interest as well. And to tap into that, that talent base of 1 in 7 or 1 in 5, as Maria said, is probably more accurate.
But like also noting that like it's been such an uphill battle to like get people to see it as like a civil rights, as a human rights issue. Because like, it's obviously like the response to it, like, and like, it's a gut response, and it's one that like was ingrained in me myself because I went to school in Ireland, and God, we love charity and we love disability charity, that like the response to disability is like, oh, you poor thing. Is there a way you can get fixed? You know, can we make it better, rather than actually acknowledging that everyone's bodies has limits, everyone's mind has limits, they're different, and there's some who we disadvantage because of impairments within that, and that actually we need to, and reframing it as a rights issue, and that actually it is that issue of equality, is huge, and it does feel like we're getting there more. Like Sinead Burke is obviously being like, I don't know, Queen of Ireland at this point is really helpful. But also like looking at like activists like, you know, Rosalind McDonagh's just started on the Human Rights Commission as a commissioner, who's like a fantastic disabled traveller activist. Seeing more people in those spaces is really important.
I completely agree, Maria. I mean, one frustration I had in the previous government, they had an equality portfolio for a Minister of State, and then they had a disability portfolio. And one thing that really irks me is when disability isn't treated as a general equality issue.
Always under health.
Yeah. Or that it's not. How is it not an equality issue, you know? So I hope, you know, it can be mainstreamed, you know, it can be seen, you know, up there with the LGBTIQA, you know, up there with the gender concerns as well. And just to pick up on a point, another important point, Maria, I think that really just resonated with me when you're talking about the role that art has to play. You know, that's something I feel really strongly about. I mean, you know, I work in policy, the power, like the potential and to advance social issues through law and policy, I mean, is huge and vital. But the role that kind of popular culture plays, you know, whether that be films, books, podcasts, what does this play in terms of fostering empathy, you know, and creating awareness, isn't to be underestimated either, you know. And it's ultimately, I mean, there's this great quote by, you know, Kathleen Moran, the English journalist and feminist icon, that it was okay to be gay on Top of the Pops years before it was okay to be gay in Parliament, you know. So sometimes can have a much bigger impact on your life as an individual, you know, if there's kind of social tolerance and cultural awareness, than whether you know, in the letter of the law have rights, but you know, society isn't there yet, you know.
Yeah.
And that acceptance, I suppose, is vital in ensuring that policies created kind of see that, you know, people with disabilities are not just a, you know, a separate section of society, but just part of every community. And, you know, as like, it shouldn't be, like you were saying, they're segregated off into health, but, you know, kind of enclosed in, well, how will climate policies, how will they affect the portion of our society who, you know, the sections of our society that do have disabilities at the moment. But it is so often segregated off that you do end up with kind of disjointed or unthinking policies. I remember listening to a man from the, I believe he's from the Irish Wheelchair Association, telling me that wheelchair accessible does not mean a person with the wheelchair could live in the house. It means they could access the house. And that just blew my mind. And it just, like, so much, like, if, like, non-joined up thinking. But I was wondering, is there any inroads that either of you are seeing, especially, like, I suppose I know I keep focusing on environment and climate, but into, like, ensuring that disability is integrated with environmental policies coming up, or is that a battle?
I think it's going to be a battle, if I'm completely honest. I think like part of the issue is that even though disabled people are going to disproportionately suffer as a result of the climate crisis, there has been some of the like popular movements around like the environment stuff, and I say popular, not effective. Like the stuff around straws has sort of pitted, like it's created a division between like the disability community and the like environmental justice community. And like, I've been disabled my whole life, but I've been like vocal about the climate crisis far longer than I've been vocal about being disabled. It like breaks my heart to see that division, but it's just something that happened because the straw ban became the like go-to thing, and it was like, okay, we're going to fix the entire climate crisis by banning straws. And straws are an accessibility device, and they're actually probably one of the like first real examples of true universal design that we've ever had. Like, they were originally only to be found in hospitals or in like nursing homes or other disability institutions. And then everyone decided that they liked them because they were good for kids and they were good for all of these other things. And all of a sudden, you know, straws became whatever bar you went into, or whatever, back when you could go into bars, or whatever restaurant you were in, you could, you mightn't be able to get in the door, but if you got in, you would at least be guaranteed be able to drink. And they're gone now. Like it's not even a case that we're like, it's not even a case that like, oh, we're about to get rid of them. Like, most bars you go into will have like biodegradable straws, which you can't use in hot drinks, which aren't bendable, which aren't actually suitable as like an accessibility device. Well, possibly just the bars I go to be fair. But like we've now lost that, like one of the few areas where we had actually really won access stuff.
Yeah, but Maria, we saved the planet, so
we have that one turtle. That one turtle with a straw on its nose that has haunted me. It kind of breaks my heart when I see friends carrying around straws now. I'm like, that was something we won. That was there. Even like cycling infrastructure, and like I say this as a cyclist, and now I'm the world's wobbliest cyclist. I love my bike. I will never be able to learn to drive anyway. And cycling infrastructure is something that's hugely important for me in like not dying and being able to like commute effectively and in an environmentally sustainable way. But like a lot of the time when we build cycling infrastructure, we do it in a way that doesn't take into account visually impaired people and blind people, and sort of do these segregated lanes that make it like impossible to get to a bus stop, and make it more difficult to navigate, and don't necessarily provide people with the tools to do that. And I say this as someone who spent a lot of time crying out for more cycling infrastructure, mm-hmm. or complaining about drivers. But we're not necessarily doing that in an accessible way. We have this opportunity to build an accessible, sustainable society. And I think now, like, we're, I suppose, going through this COVID thing and people are actually really talking about the kind of place they want to live in. And we're talking about more pedestrianization and all of these wonderful things. There is that chance there to seize it and become an accessible, sustainable society. But I don't know in my heart if we do it. Like, it's the dream, but I don't think we're there yet. And I don't think either movement has necessarily, I think the disability rights movement, particularly in like the Pacific Island countries, have been like hugely, hugely active on environmental issues in the way that the Pacific Island nations have sort of had to be. And I do think there's possibly a little bit more awareness there that it's going to impact them. But I don't think that allyship or that like ability to work together is there yet. Which, and again, like these aren't separate movements. There's a lot between them, in terms of the fact that a lot of people within the environmental justice movements will, and green movements will have disabilities, and a lot of disabled people will be green activists. But I don't think you have that crossover yet. Sorry for a bit of a rant there.
No, it's very interesting, Maria. Like, definitely, I was when I was doing my interview for IRIC, you were brilliant, and it just really eye opening as well. I mean, it really comes down for me, really about kind of business, like how frightened are we of actually challenging business as usual? I suppose, because you're right, what climate justice kind of work would do on Pacific kind of islands, the small island states, and disability rights activists and the LGBT groups, as you mentioned as well, Deirdre, and feminist groups, is really about kind of upending the way things are kind of acceptable to be. And the what we kind of get crushed back into again and again, and kind of where we're gaining ground, but like there's kind of a pushback where cosmetic kind of procedures or cosmetic changes are put on top. So banning the straws, you know, then the turtle is saved, or, you know, the keep cup, you know, which really actually, that was something for me. Now I realized that with those keep cups, how much kind of risk of bacteria, even before COVID, were you putting on kind of low level service staff as well, asking them to, you know, take your keep cup, God knows where it was, and then put it for the coffee. But so like that kind of upending business as usual, is really the challenge that making a more accessible society requests of us. And we spoke in the last podcast there about capitalism and climate, and I'm resorting to reading science fiction to try and imagine my way out of it, but which is hard. But Deirdre, you had a very interesting insight as well on the same kind of issue of the lack of accessibility of kind of urban environments, even though, you know, you're kind of forced to live in urban environments because of that lack of public transport. And again, there's an example of the straws, the idea that we can all own electric cars, which are expensive, but, you know, the accessibility of those cars and that type of climate approach as well for rural Ireland. I didn't actually think about that at that level either. But I'd love to hear more about your perspective on kind of, you were talking to about College Green before, and the accessibility of kind of urban environments and the clash with cycling infrastructure as well.
Sure, yeah. So for me anyway, as someone who is legally blind and often has to navigate College Green, it's a nightmare. You've got rail meets road, you've got cyclists, you know, you really just have to get into lockstep with someone in between you and a car and just hope for the best, you know. So hope if that was pedestrianized, that would be brilliant. From my perspective, just on the cycling issue, I'm actually, as I said, I'm the only person in my family who's legally blind, but I'm probably the most thrill seeking and the person who enjoys cycling the most. Like between lockdown one and two, I did attempt to do the Greenway, you know, in Waterford, and I loved it. You know, I love cycling. If the cycle lanes, I just were off the road. If I'm vying for space with a motorist, I mean, that's just a recipe for potentially fatal disaster. You know, well, if there were cycle lanes were on the footpath and were somehow accessible, maybe am I asking for too much there? But I would love the opportunity to be able to cycle. I don't know what bollards between. This is a wish list now, but bollards between the cycle lane and the footpath or something. You know. And definitely just off the road. And I spent a lot of time in rural Ireland as well. And just, you are kind of, you do give up your agency having to be chauffeured from A to B. And similar to the straw issue, I know someone who, I mean, using a straw allows them to be independent, you know, in a cafe situation. What's more important than your independence? I mean, it makes you someone with a disability, you often have to ask for help. And you feel very small doing that, you know. There's a reason children instinctively want to do things by themselves and take pride in being able to do things by themselves and to look after themselves. As with like, I suppose any crisis, you know, be that economic or climate or public health, it's kind of a rule, unfortunately, that always holds true, that people who are vulnerable will be disproportionately impacted. We at the Irish Council for Civil Liberties have been calling for a human rights impact assessment, that the government would carry out a human rights impact assessment in the context of COVID, to ensure that the government endeavours to take measures that safeguard populations that are already marginalised. And I think the same holds true when you consider the climate crisis and the disabled population who are already in a vulnerable position. I think I mentioned before, like the labour market, and that I'd be positive in hoping that there's a tipping point there. There's a great initiative founded by an Irish woman. She's a social entrepreneur who has a disability herself, Caroline Casey. So she launched an initiative at Davos last year, and her thinking is that once business takes disability seriously, had the same as when business took environmental sustainability seriously, then society will. So she's, you know, turning towards business. So it's called, the initiative is called The Valuable 500, and she's looking for 500 companies to put disability on their board agenda. So to treat disability as kind of a corporate priority. And she thinks that that's will drive change. That's an initiative that's worth checking out. It's called The Valuable 500. It's headed up by an Irish woman.
And going back there to what Saoirse mentioned, the question about, I mean, that's great about the international initiative for people on boards. But I mean, do you feel that if there's human rights assessments going on and kind of an analysis of government policy from a human rights perspective, do you feel included in terms of climate action and the state and people with disabilities? I mean, the Paris Agreement, the preamble requires states to take into account and to have meaningful participation of people with disabilities, women, children and the elderly. I know Sinead Burke is really, really interested on the rights of the child and the voice of the child in such environments. But I mean, like, are there actually any initiatives at the moment for the inclusion of people with disabilities in climate action law and policy, you know, from an ICCL and also from the NUIG, Maria, as well? Have you noticed that occurring, and what difference would it make? I mean, what is the vision for a more accessible Ireland if we have this opportunity to reshape things, to create a better world in general?
I think I wouldn't necessarily hold as much hope in the business side of things, possibly. But I think actually that engagement of people with disabilities is like really crucial and something that we don't see. And it is something that's kind of guaranteed under the Convention on the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, the UNCRPD, that right to political participation is guaranteed. And that's, I suppose, what's guided documents that have been published since then. But political participation of people with disabilities in this country in particular is really under threat. For like one of the things that Deirdre mentioned when she talked about like COVID and that we are being like, and the disproportionate impact that it had, CRPD under Article 11 does recognise like the, I suppose, particularly precarious position of people with disability or disabled people under the context of like situations of emergency or in those risks. And we've seen in COVID where like pretty much like across the globe, people with disabilities were told to stay indoors, do not stick your head outdoors, and all should be fine, and we will deliver you tinned soup. And the same can of tin soup by the accounts of my friends in the UK.
Oh no!
72 cans of tomato soup was what I saw one woman was delivered to get her through that, which they obviously paid Tesco a huge amount of money for, the cheap tomato soup that was probably awful. But we've seen the disproportionate impact that COVID has had on disabled people. Like from cocooning to shielding to whatever a state has called it, like we're in so much trouble as the climate crisis worsens. Like if we look at what happened in California earlier this year with some of their worst forest fires. Actually, has it just been all year? I think California might have been on fire all year.
It's been a bad
year. I think
year.
It's still on fire, in fact.
I think, it kind of looks like it relit, but did it ever go out? Like the air quality stuff there has had such a massive impact on people with disabilities in particular, because obviously if you have a pre-existing condition, if you have a disability, you're in so much danger there that like there's a lot of people who haven't left their house all year between climate and COVID. Like that's where we're at. I think if we look at other like situations of like mass migration, if we look at war, like a lot of the stuff that came, like if we look at the Syrian war, one disabled person or one wheelchair user making it to Europe, where she was probably put back on a boat given Europe's current policy, But like made like international news and was like the feel good story of the year. But the fact is that a lot of disabled people weren't able to navigate that migration route. And like the fact that migration is going to be such a enormous part of the climate crisis, like disabled people don't necessarily have the option to get in those tiny awful boats. And like hopefully by the time the worst bit of the climate refugee crisis hits, we'll, you know, be a little bit more humane towards refugees and towards refugees, but like disabled people are going to be really disadvantaged in that and the worst those worst elements of it, like globally, not just in Ireland. Like it's going to cause significant issues, which completely diverts from the point of political participation, just in terms of like actual responses to emergencies, disabled people are always disadvantaged.
I was wondering, Deirdre, like Maria, you touched on it there, but what are your thoughts on, I suppose, you know, hoping that if business starts to take disability seriously, because, you know, I know business has started to take the environment seriously and everything is just getting worse and worse and worse. So I was wondering, like, do you have any, like, do you have hope that this could be done in a way that isn't just like the most cynical kind of aren't we such a nice company kind of, yeah. I don't know, something washing.
Could I just come in on the consultation point and then I'll
of course yeah
thanks yeah just in terms of consultation, like they often use the phrase, you know, nothing about us without us. I think it's crucial when you're designing any type of policy. I mean, the more inclusive a consultation is in the policy formation process, the more robust the policy will be, the more effective it will be. And the same holds true for in the case of designing policy and including people with disability in that. I mean, I've had the experience once where I was advocating about the inaccessibility of a certain recruitment stream, and the answer I got was, well, how then do we ensure that people with other disabilities, such as people with mental health issues like psychosocial disabilities, aren't at advantage, you know? So there is this frustration. I mean, my disability, I'm just acutely aware of this as speaking as someone with a disability, that I can't speak for all people with disabilities. I can't even speak for all people who have a visual impairment, you know. So that wide consultation, sometimes people say, oh, I knew someone, you know, who had bad eyesight, or I know someone who's disabled and they found this was very helpful, or, you know. So I think that wide consultation and kind of wide engagement is crucial, you know. And people think if they've gotten the opinion of one person or one organization, that's, you know, a box tick, you know.
I met one person with a cane 5 years ago, I got it.
Exactly, yeah. People say to me, you must have, They were saying, oh, I knew a neighbour who had very poor vision, and they were just, they had exceptional hearing. Like, I actually prefer to see things written down. You know, I have to go extremely close, break my back to see it. But, you know, I actually, you know, people are so willing to box you. So that's why I think broad-based engagement is important. And then on the second point on my faith in business, definitely wouldn't be naive to the kind of PR mileage they can get out of having, you know, someone with a visual disability on their banner. You know, I mean, diversity and inclusion is its own market at the moment, you know. But I would maybe take a more pragmatic view, and if companies are willing to put that on the board agenda and to actively kind of celebrate, disability wouldn't be the same as maybe other issues like LGBTI, where there's kind of something you want to celebrate. But if they want to kind of actively employ or engage with people who are disabled to have to apply a more broad interpretation of equality, then that's great. I know that's very pragmatic. I wouldn't be naive enough to think they're doing it out of the goodness of their corporate bottom line driven hearts, you know. But if it means that there are more kind of employment attitudes and the companies are more sensitized to the challenges that people with disabilities face in terms of seeking employment, then maybe it's not perfect, but it is progress. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe I would say, I mean, law and policy isn't the answer. There are attitudinal barriers. Popular and culture alone isn't the answer. We need, you know, we need rights protected, enshrined in law. You know, so I'd say combination. We need societal kind of attitudinal change, and we need progress in terms of law and policy as well. And then no harm then if companies are taking a lead, be it for cynical PR purposes as well.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of, I mean, analogous in a way to the environmental, like Sinead Burke appeared on the cover of Vogue. I mean, many people have criticized Vogue for years and years that it was such a, you know, tiny kind of tall, slim, American, usually kind of model. And that was the only kind of conception of beauty, or even someone that loved fashion would be someone that fitted that kind of very tiny kind of clothing size. But I mean, by appearing on their cover and having done so much work with them, she's made huge inroads that then can allow for maybe wider discussions of disability or accessibility. So no, I would agree. And on climate, it's kind of the same. You get in there with the keep cup and then your cup overfloweth.
Exactly. And even to say, as most devoted fans, it was just so touching. She was saying that she got a lot of photos from parents of children who were little people as well, holding the cover of her, you know. So even just for that, you know, to be a role model for people to see themselves, you know, you can't be what you can't see.
Of course, yeah.
So even that's some positive, even though I know she came in for criticism. I just think that's an important part of that discussion as well.
Yeah, definitely. I used to love Vogue. I covered my whole bedroom like when I was 16, and pictures from Vogue. I know, but like it actually made me like feel shit about myself. I was like, oh, after a month or two, I was like, why haven't I eaten as much?
Oh God,
maybe it's the pictures of Scarlett Johansson. But anyway.
But like, there is a huge advantage to, I suppose, normalizing diversity in people's everyday lives. And like, I know, like, from my own experience of being disabled and being gay and being a woman, that like seeing people who look like me in places of power I don't think it happened back then. I think the only gay people when I was growing up were Ellen and Elton John. But like, the more you see of that does have an impact on your own self-worth. It is part of that picture of, I suppose, achieving change.
Yeah, brilliant, definitely. And I suppose, how would you see the kind of that participatory, so moving beyond kind of being what you can see and moving beyond kind of representation? So that was something I noticed myself as well, I suppose, after the crash. during the recession, there was a lot of kind of like probably pretty well-founded fear that young people were extremely angry that they couldn't find work, and that they couldn't, you know, there was the ban on this, on civil service kind of employment. You know, most of the political arena as well, you know, was much, much older. I think the average age at the time around 2012 was maybe 45 was the average age of a politician in the Dáil. And the focus then was kind of on representation. So even I remember attending kind of events where I was asked my opinion as a young people on politics and inclusivity and employment. But I mean, it was just kind of for show. And then JobsBridge was kind of brought in, or unpaid internships. And though those were criticized by younger people, it was kind of like, well, you should take what you can get, you know. And I suppose, how do you move beyond representation to the stronger policy of meaningful participation, and what would that look like, you know?
So I think there's a couple of issues here. Like, one of them is obviously getting disabled people everywhere, like at all levels where decisions are made, and like at all tables where decisions are made. And that's really important, as well as but there's actually like quite a key issue in terms of, like, Deirdre talked already about the idea of nothing about us without us. Part of the reason why that's such a pertinent part of disability and disability identity and disability in politics is that there is a whole bunch of people who think that they can talk for us. Constantly, like, we're like, it's written into the convention, or it's not written into the convention specifically, it's written into some of the stuff that's flown from the convention, the General Commons, that like we have to be very clear that like service provider organizations can't speak on behalf of disabilities. And that's pretty much what we have in Ireland right now. We don't have disabled persons organizations, which is to say rights focused organizations led by disabled people at every table. We tend to have organizations that are dominated by service providers or parents of people with disabilities, or disability experts who don't have lived experience of disability at those tables and at those seats of power. And that's really damaging on a number of levels. Like firstly, service providers and disabled people have an obvious conflict of interest. A lot of the rights violations experienced by disabled people in this country will be at the hands of service providers. While there's a lot of really incredible ones out there, this is also where we see institutionalized living and use of restraint and all of these things. So I think that fundamental parity, we need to move from disabled charities or disability organizations to full disabled persons organizations and really hear the voice of disabled people, because we're not right now. We're spending a lot of money to hear non-disabled people talk about what disabled people need. And I think that's particularly key for like political participation and actually ensuring that like when we start moving towards more positive climate action, start moving towards more positive climate action, that representation of disability is like meaningful, because a lot of the time when we hear from disabled people, we're hearing from non-disabled people, which is like still something I'm really struggling to get my head around, and why saying you should listen to disabled people is controversial is also something I still haven't quite figured out, but that's where we're at now.
And Deirdre, what about yourself, what would you use?
Agree and share Maria's frustrations. Another thing that struck me there while Maria was speaking was just that as someone with disability, I remember infamously saying to someone through gritted teeth when I was just coming up against challenges, you know, accessibility challenges. I was in college at the time. I remember saying, I don't want to be a disability activist, you know, and they were saying, but then the penny
absolutely.
But I have to be. I actually have to be an advocate for myself, as everyone does. But when you have a disability, you know, you actually have to advocate for yourself all the time. And what you're essentially doing, for me, I really struggled with this. I think I'm getting better with age, but I really don't like to draw attention to myself, especially as my disability is fairly visually distinctive anyway. You know, so you're essentially, again and again, people, whether it's you're talking to people about trying to convince them to give you a job, or whether, you know, you don't want people to write you off. So just trying to strike this balance the whole time between, please acknowledge this, but also don't write me off because of this, you know. So that's something I still trying to hit the mark, you know, with my own disability advocacy. I was a bit of a denier, you know. I used to just try and stumble my way through the mainstream because I didn't want to stick out for the wrong reasons or be written off, you know. But I just find, I really admire people like Sinead Burke and Maria, you know, who can speak so eloquently and so kind of compellingly about their experience. I mean, I found that very difficult to do for a long time, but ultimately to empower myself, I have to learn to do that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. I wouldn't be worried about challenging the mainstream. It's causing climate change, so.
Yeah.
But go on, Saoirse, were you trying to come in there?
No, I was just going to say, and like, causing everything else that's rubbish. Like, I think the mainstream needs more challenging. But just back to one point you were making there, Deirdre, a while ago, it got me thinking, you were talking about cycling. There was a group over from, I think it was Amsterdam, long ago when I was in the Green Party, there was a cycling like club or something over from Amsterdam, and they were cycling around with some of the Green Party councillors, I think. And their comment afterwards was like, oh my God, how does anyone cycle in Dublin? It's terrifying. It is completely like terrible, a terrible, terrible, terrifying place to cycle in. Why do you do it? So like,
you accept death, Saoirse, that's what you do. You just accept it's coming.
Yeah. I wouldn't know, like, I'm still in awe at people who cycle in Dublin. Like, I've been on buses in Dublin and watched the cyclists like pinned between the bus and the footpath, and I'm like, Jesus Christ. And like,
it could be a much more accessible form of transport if we actually had cycling infrastructure. Like, it really, like, I was like pumping the air when Deirdre was talking about it. Like, it could be an actually accessible form of public transport, but no, you instead have to play leapfrog with the like 42 ton buses. And it's terrifying. And if I hadn't learned to cycle in, I learned to cycle in the Netherlands after years and years and years and years of trying, and I still cycle an old Dutch bike that will probably survive my inevitable accident with a bus. But like, it's just, it's so, like, there's so many people who clearly want to cycle in Dublin.
I'd love to cycle. I just think, like, who, you would always blame the legally blind person if there was an accident, even if I was being really, you know, careful and wasn't at fault. I mean, you know, you're going to be blamed.
Oh no.
But the amount, like, the amount, it's quite, I was just talking today with my partner, we were saying, like, the amount of cyclists that were killed in Dublin alone this year was massive, and still, I think it was Pat Kenny on being like, are we being held ransom by the needs of the few, talking about cyclists or something like that. And I was like, it's actually crazy when you start to think, like they're just, people are being killed every single month in Dublin, and everyone's like, this is fine, let's not just put in a few minor changes in our public transport, in our transport systems, because, you know, we don't want to inconvenience people by an extra 4 seconds at a red light or something.
Yeah, I love a good bus though. Coming home from the pub and getting into a cozy bus, you know, and the bus driver lets you off the €2.50 because, you know, that's a good side. No, what is it? I get it. I always get free trips from the bus drivers. I chat away to them.
One, that's just you, Sinead. Like, the rest
just
of
me?
Yeah, just you. Definitely on Dublin bus anyway. But, you know, if you have really good cycling infrastructure, like really good cycling infrastructure, you don't need to get the bus home. You can take the bike home. And like, the worst that would happen to you would be that you'd end up in a bush. But you can't, like, so it could be like, it could be the good way home at the end of the night, after a few pints would be in a properly accessible, properly resourced cycling system. You could just take the bike and you wouldn't even have to pay the €2.50. You wouldn't have to chat to anyone.
I love the chat.
But like, what, just, you know, before the bus stops had names, like, that was, you're just riding, you know, on a wing and a prayer, like hoping that the bus driver would let you know. You know, I mean, you can't go by visual descriptions. I mean, that's for anyone, even normal sighted or non-disabled, like trying to, you just have to know where, you just have to know where you were going before bus stops had names.
And has the difference been reading out the name on the bus, Deirdre? Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they say next stop, blah, blah, blah. But before that, I don't, like, did the bus stops even have names? Were you just meant to know where you were going and where to get off?
Yeah, or even where to get the bus. You just threw your hand out in Carrow and it would just stop. There was no bus.
Yeah, but that's the 424. That's a yeah, different world again.
424, well, I don't know. They should, I think it's definitely improved, but it used to be like you would work in Galway City and you would finish work at 6, but the last bus would be at 5:30. It was just ridiculous, you know, so there was no way to, but now they've changed it, I think, because of the students. Now it's a bit different, but
there's new ones on, I think.
Yeah, there's new ones on, but still, anyway, my dad was saying that you have a whole generation now, including probably mine, which is, you know, we've been socialized towards the car rather than using the bus.
But also, those rural buses, that 424 is completely inaccessible, because while it does stop anywhere you want it to, which is very useful, it has like that terrifying lift that I've only seen used maybe twice in terms of like wheelchair accessibility, and otherwise it's an entirely inaccessible bus service. If you live in Connemara and you have a physical disability of any description, like it's completely impossible to rely on that bus service.
They're coaches, are they?
Yeah.
Okay. Same here.
The city buses, as like much as like you don't particularly want to be standing on a bus in rural Ireland, and they are actually very accessible, and that's come from disability advocacy. Buses are actually a really central, like, accessible public transport was like one of the first real I suppose, protest movements in the disability rights in disability rights history. There's quite a lot of people who will tell you how to stop a bus with a wheelchair and how to jam a wheelchair into a bus's wheel.
Wow.
Like there's a massive radical history in disability rights, because in order to get anything done, you've kind of had to go to the extremes. So like in California, there was like mad sit-ins that lasted for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and involved the Black Panthers and quite a few rock bands.
Tell us more about those, Maria. That'd be amazing.
So the Section 504 riots, which were, and again, our history is really recent. So like the woman who's sort of at the center of the Section 504 riots, Judy Heumann, is like someone I've got to meet a few times. She lives in DC, and I've gotten lunch with her. But she was like a young disability activist, and there was this idea that like, okay, we have to, that public, there was basically, because America was actually slightly ahead in disability rights before, you know, they decided to go to the dark ages. Not recently, it's been bad for a while. So basically there was an executive order to make all public buildings accessible, or at least nominally accessible. And it was just never signed. It was never enforced. And so disability rights activists who apparently, I've asked Judy about this, and she was like, it was very easy to organize. A lot of people were living in the same large institutions, so you just had to call a few places to get quite a few people. But they occupied the buildings, and most occupations lasted like 72 hours or less, except for like one, or one of the California, I think it was San Francisco, their public works office. That occupation lasted just weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And, you know, people bringing in like medical supplies because people need, and food, and like massive solidarity from like other disability, or other activist groups in like the late 60s in the US. And it was incredible. And like, you know, in the UK, like here we had like quite a few people who had like a real ability to shame politicians by just sleeping out in front of the door. Again, I'm thinking of one rights activist who was like, if you just turn up in a wheelchair and say you're not going, and there's these news cameras there, it actually makes for good TV, and you can get quite a bit done. Or, you know, in the UK, I was looking at, it's 30 years since some of their like really significant riots, and again, focused around public transport and accessible public transport. And you could just say they just hooked themselves to the buses because they wanted to be able to use London Bus. So you can hook three whole disabled people to a bus. Person underneath, one person in the front, and one person in the back. And you can use wheelchairs to stop buses. So again, like...
Amazing. Absolute legend. Yeah.
Like, there's a really cool history here.
Hello,
lawyer. She can I be heard?
Oh yes, sorry. Yep. I think it just stopped. Sorry.
Okay. Harry McBride Johnson was in the States, and she talks about hanging out in like mainly queer, mainly Crip circles. And there is that radical history that, like, I think we forget a lot in Ireland in particular, when, you know, we love our charity model. But like, yeah, like there's a few, like, and you know, like the Green Movement also has like quite radical roots. And there's quite a lot of like that there is, I suppose, different tactics that people have been used that could be considered extreme, but that are brilliant. Basically, I can't think of the lads in the UK who glued themselves to the tube. The energy lads, the Extinction Rebellion. There we go.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Yeah.
Like Extinction Rebellion gluing themselves to the tube, which the tube is actually energy efficient, but you know, like those public demonstrations have a significant history in the disability movement as well.
Deirdre, will the ICCL be gluing itself to bike lanes? No, wait, sorry. Which is it? The cars? That's what we do. The SUVs. That's a fascinating history. Absolutely fascinating.
I'm not sure if it's on the agenda. It's actually interesting. One of our founders, Mary Robinson, one of the founders of the ICCL in 1976, currently heads up, as you're aware, the Mary Robinson Foundation, you know, and it's just the tagline, climate justice. So it just really brings in those strands that we're discussing here, like the kind of indivisibility of inclusivity and sustainability. So I think it really attests to green policy or climate, the need for climate action is arguably the defining human rights concern of our time. But yeah, I'm not sure if it's on the agenda of the lying across cycle lanes at the moment.
Yeah, I suppose it's so interesting that it's also interdependent. I mean, like, I think, Saoirse, you were telling me about the Black Lives Matter UK. So they took over London City Airport and they refused to move because they were saying, you know, the climate crisis is a racist crisis. And London City Airport is used most by kind of people who, you know, fly to meetings for one day in London and fly back to like South Africa and so on. Like people, frequent flyers who don't have to fly at all and are using up the last bits of carbon space that mostly developing countries and, you know, people in those countries would need. So it's deeply racist in kind of its operation. And I suppose in many ways it's ableist as well. I mean, it's the people with disabilities are the most vulnerable to climate, and yet they've done absolutely nothing to kind of contribute it to it, you know? So kind of the analogies there are quite interesting, I think.
There's a woman, I think she's excellent. Her name is Afko. She's a black vegan activist scholar from the US, and I'm pretty sure it was her. She was talking about how, you know, sometimes as activists or whatever, you can start to feel like, you know, if your cause is a backpack you're carrying, you can start to feel like, you know, I don't have the energy to add in something else. So I don't have the energy, say I'm an environmental activist, say I don't have the energy to deal with, you know, with racism or discrimination or any of these things. But if you actually put your backpack down and start emptying it out, you can see actually that you're already carrying all those things with you, and they're already in there. And if you just repackage them, you'll be able to, they'll feel lighter, but the interdependence of them, you'll be able to, you know, get support and solidarity from other movements and say, look, you know, I'm not going to focus all my energy on whatever, but I support you and I'm with you and I see how our struggles are the same struggle. And likewise, and, you know, her idea is that only through that kind of recognizing that almost every struggle that you can think of is deeply interconnected, because, you know, when it comes down to it, a lot of it is to do with power. Only by doing that will, you know, we ever get to a kind of some sort of utopia, which actually just made me think of another thing where myself and Sinead was and Lorna went to a little exercise where we were writing out what our perfect world would be. And Lorna was like, wow, I realize my perfect world is just like a world where the council is really well funded and there's like lovely accessible public spaces, and that's it. And it's just so achievable.
Mine is just the chats. Yeah. Safe chats, lots of food, lots of fun. But so I actually, speaking on that, that's a really beautiful image as well, Saoirse. But in terms of support and solidarity, I saw you both tweeting, Maria and Deirdre and Saoirse as well, about the mother and baby homes issue. And I suppose the kind of the same sort of pattern of infantilization or dismissal or not listening, refusing to allow other voices to participate. But then, you know, kind of this kind of, I suppose, sound washing or kind washing of, you know, apologizing for what happened in the mother and baby homes or apologizing for the Magdalen laundries, but then refusing to allow those voices to challenge power, because to do so, to kind of, to open up that box of Irish history and the relationship between the state and the church and the activity of the state to vulnerable or targeted groups. The pattern is the same, whether it's direct provision, whether it's people with disabilities. The Grace case is another example of where that kind of power dynamic, closed off, secret kind of institutionalization, that same practice of institutionalization, practice on vulnerable groups or targeted groups, in Irish society. So I'd just like to hear your own perspective, I suppose, as kind of maybe our finishing thoughts. So maybe we'll end with more kind of happy thoughts after this thought. But Maria, if you want to kind of maybe, I saw you were doing a lot of work there with NUIG and Maeve O'Rourke.
I was doing no work with Maeve O'Rourke, but I will retweet everything that woman says because she's brilliant. To my shame, I've done very little on it, but I do see it as quite a lot of disabled women were in the mother and baby homes and in the Magdalen laundries. Quite a lot of women were disabled by their experiences in that and acquired disabilities while they were there. Similarly to how, you know, people are going to get more disabilities because of the climate crisis. But a lot of people were, but there is a significant disability history there, and quite a lot of disabled people were never fully emancipated from those homes. And I think one of the things for me that we need to, obviously the whole process has been horrific, and like the access to justice implications in particular, where like in order to access the redress scheme, you had to, you know, agree to not sue the state or sign away your other access to justice or your other your rights to other remedies is really problematic. The silencing of people's voices in the process, at no point are people really given that opportunity to truly articulate the issues that concerns them. It's so time sensitive, given I'm thinking of, you know, people I know myself who are becoming much, much older, who are never going to see any form of redress. But for me, the disability history there is that actually Ireland loves institutions. We love nursing homes. We love direct provision centres, that kind of institutionalisation. The Magdalen laundries, the mother and baby homes, all of them, and the disability institutions that currently exist. And I'm not I don't think it's as severe in other countries, and the access to justice provisions around them and the lack of access to justice definitely isn't. But I think there's something about Ireland's particular history that means we will always shy towards an institutional mode of social control that's just so damaging, so dehumanizing, and is such an affront to autonomy and human dignity. And we just haven't confronted that on any level.
Yeah, and I suppose even with the climate crisis, I mean, we're going to see mass displacement. We're going to see perhaps more people even coming to the, you know, kind of more temperate climates. And is our response going to be further institutionalization, even of people in coastal communities that have to move, but they might not have the full capacity? Will we put them in homeless hubs? You know, that's our response today to homelessness. Our response to kind of migration, which is a natural phenomenon in many cases, is direct provision. So, yes, I should say the apology apparently was very significant. My uncle, Paul Redmond, who's a brilliant activist, said that it was. But Deirdre, you, what's your own views from ICCL and your personal perspective as well?
Sure, absolutely. Just to echo Maria's, I suppose, support for Maeve O'Rourke. I mean, as you're probably aware, Maeve O'Rourke herself worked with the ICCL before my time, and she continued since then to advocate for the need to for redress and accountability of historical abuse, and ran the gamut of emotions that week, you know. But just to touch on Maria's point as well about, you know, our the reliance on institutional care settings in Ireland. This is an issue which has been thrown into sharp relief by the COVID crisis, you know, just the fundamental unsuitability and indignity associated with living in a congregated setting. You know, we've seen clusters in nursing homes, we've seen clusters in direct provision centres. Disturbingly, again, you know, during the second wave, and just on that point, I think it really highlights the need for, I think the term is a continuum of care.
it seems to be in Ireland that, as distinct from other jurisdictions, the option is, if you need, you know, care supports, you either try and make it by yourself or move into a home, you know, an institution. There needs to be kind of setups in between. I know people in the UK say who make use of a day centre, you know, I think the term is a continuum of care. There needs to be other options. I mean, just this crisis has really, really highlighted that they are, care settings in general are places of aren't exactly ideal, and most people are only living in them as a last resort. And an issue that the ICCL has been campaigning for a long time is ratification of the optional protocol on the Convention Against Torture, which would require Ireland to establish an independent mechanism to supervise places of detention, and arguably for many direct provision centres and residential care homes, they are there against their will. So there is, and the crisis highlighted this again, there is a need for independent oversight of these congregated settings.
Brilliant. Great. Well, yeah, we're going to fix everything. But then, yeah, that's very, definitely the COVID crisis is really highlighting that in particular, and how kind of inept much of our responses to everyday kind of issues has been revealed. And Saoirse, I suppose we're going to have to finish up now in the next few minutes. But Saoirse, would you like to say anything kind of to finish us off, or to kind of, yeah?
Would you just, I suppose, picking up on what Maria and Deirdre were talking about there, like I suppose Achill Island has got a really kind of top heavy towards the elderly population. Like, there's so few young people and there's so many older people around, and there's one there's a couple of examples, I suppose, at least two really good examples of sheltered housing, and going up there where people who maybe, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, the family would have stayed, you know, there would have been a family here to take care of the elderly, instead of having to go off to, like, you know, I suppose some sort of like that, some sort of institutionalized care settings. They have these really nice, really warm houses where they all live, like, right beside each other, and, you know, there's a nurse and there's a doctor there, and I just feel like there's such a potential for things like that. Like, I get so afraid myself of, you know, just because I have no kids at the moment, I don't think I ever will, you know, of, like, you know, what happens when you get older. And it does feel like this is probably, you know, across the board, like the birth rates in Ireland. Now, I know Ireland has one of the youngest populations in Europe, but it's not like 50 years ago where everyone has seven or eight kids. And I do think there's so much potential for, like, communities to be able to care for people, as, you know, so it doesn't have to be just either you take care of yourself or you have to go off to some sort of institutionalized setting. And it does feel, I suppose, like the utopia. You're like, wow, what an achievable, and should be such an easy kind of, such an easy answer, such an obvious answer, is to, you know, equip communities to care for people there, you know, people who fall in between needing, you know, constant 24/7 care or, you know, independent living. So it just seems so obvious, doesn't it? But like Maria was saying, Ireland just kind of tends towards this institutionalization always. And hopefully we're looking at the end of that, and hopefully that we are constantly moving away from that now in Ireland.
Maria or Deirdre, would you like to speak to that at all, or?
I fully intend to retire to, like, an eco commune with my pals.
Yes, all of eco commune.
Like, it's going to be good. But, like, even just the idea, like, if I had kids, I wouldn't want them to be, like, I don't think I'd want to hang out with them for more than, like, the 20 years I'm supposed to be raising them, at least not constantly. Like, we should empower people to make their own decisions as to their care, and like we mightn't like, yeah, we should empower people to make their decisions to their own care and also get to like determine that part of their lives. Like, you know, 65 to 85 is as significant as 0 to 20, but it's kind of written off.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be.
Mm.
No, and it's not like you need, you know, I'm not saying you need your kids to mind you, but I do think so many people even just feel lonely and are like, okay, well, I don't even have someone popping in to visit me. You know, I may as well go into a nursing home or something like that. So no, I'm not saying, you know, everyone, yeah, you have to mind your parents and like they would want to have to mind them.
But it is like, if we have like these accessible local communities that are community focused, like if we, that are sustainable, like if we paint that ideal world, that utopia, like you do see greater community involvement. You do see that people a turn away from institutionalized methods of care. Like if you have like the sustainable model for living is everyone sort of existing within that 5K, which makes that life in a community and living as part of a community so much more realistic. And like throughout the life course.
Yeah, definitely. And it's about building resilience as well. I mean, climate change won't require like damage to infrastructure, but what would it do to communities? And how would you build the resilience for the climate change that will happen, or for the, you know, the greater storms, the temperature increases? We're already, I suppose, going to probably hit 1.5, if not 2. So, you know, are we building those kind of small scale, dependent, kind of close knit and resilient communities? You know, what are we doing in Ireland to do that? It'd be interesting. I suppose we're going to have to leave it there. Unless, dear, did you want to come in and say a few words as well?
Sure, yeah. No, just yeah. Someone that came to mind there, just an example, what I was about. My point about the continuum of care that both Saoirse and Maria referred to as well, just of a, for example, a good friend of mine acquired a disability, a road accident, a good friend of mine from college, and he now needs care, he needs support, but he's still, his brain is still very active, you know, he's same as me, he's 30, you know, he's right and, you know, to be intellectually stimulated, but also to receive care. But the option for him is either his parents to take over his care completely or to be in a nursing home. I mean, people in their 80s don't want to be in a nursing home. Who wants to be in one in their 20s and 30s, you know? So his family have actually very admirably established this foundation called Unsail. So it'll be a day's care centre for people with acquired brain injuries, you know, where they can go for respite, go for physio, go for therapy instead of, you know, just that kind of binary option, either just you need institutional care and there's no rehab, or you're at home. So just that, I'm making that point very much with him and the Unsail project in mind.
Great. Yes, I think my cousin is in Camp Hill as well, and a friend of mine works in Camp Hill up north, and it seems to be a very good example as well. But
what was scary just on that point as well, is what was disturbing. And they said, how can we have data on people with acquired brain injuries in Ireland who are in the nursing home system? And they didn't have that data. You know, they couldn't say, you know, so I think that's just very telling.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Like lack of data. And that's never going to happen unless people, you know, like yourselves are at the table and included meaningfully as well. That conversation won't happen. It's a gap in the thinking at the moment. But we're going to have to leave it there. And just before I go, I just want to say, Deirdre, you said there that you were worried, you know, about being being compelling enough or finding yourself put into this position, but you've been absolutely fantastic, and it's just a pleasure listening to you talking on this topic, and yourself as well, Maria, and thank you so much. You're really, really insightful, and you know, I'm really enjoying your tweets as well, Maria, in general. Very, very informative. So
too many tweets.
They're great. I love tweeting. It's like company during COVID. But thank you so both so much, and looking forward to working with you as we spoke about interdependent movements. Looking forward to doing this together. So thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks a million, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Oh, sorry, I'm going to stop recording.